Today I have a special treat for you, Mason Williams, who, if I say classical gas, everybody's heard. That tune has been covered by hundreds and hundreds of artists. Huge, huge hit. That was Mason Williams. That's the one thing that he did that he publicly cannot deny. Add in there another 30 albums, a career as a folk singer that began in Oklahoma, bluegrass musician, obviously master guitar player, composer, head comedy writer for the Smothers Brothers. He's the guy that hired that guy named Steve Martin to assist him to write comedy for Smothers Brothers. Mason Williams has a career that is just, I've never run across anyone quite like him. You're going to hear today in the second hour, a half hour of our conversation, which has been broken up into four parts because there's so much to cover. Nice start off, kickoff with Mason Williams and all of the visual artists. He has art in the art museums. It really is, as I say, after I talked to him and got to know him over the last couple months to prepare for this, you, as I was, will be dumbfounded. You will just be amazed at all the things. And he still has this incredible sense of humor that comes through from the moment that we start chatting. So please stick around for that. Coming up now, first part of Mason Williams' interview. Wonderful time with Mason. You're going to enjoy this. Stick around about a half an hour, and then we're going to play a couple, two tunes that we specifically mentioned in the interview. We'll follow immediately after the interview. I'm just going to sit back and listen to it because I enjoy it.
Hello, this is Mason Williams, and you are listening to the other Steve Martin, not the Hollywood movie Steve Martin, but the Kentucky radio Steve Martin on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass.
I'm very happy to have, as a guest today on Unreal Bluegrass, Mason Williams. Mason, how are you today?
Doing very well. It's sunny here in Oregon, and a beautiful day, and nice and warm.
Nice and warm. It's warm here, too. I'm in the Midwest. I'm in Kentucky, and it's a beautiful spring, verging on summer day here, and this is a perfect time for us to talk about all the music that Mason Williams, I could say this, and everybody on the whole planet, and I don't know, did they put this on that little gold plate that they sent out with Voyager? Did classical gas make it onto the gold plate that was sent out to the far? If not, it should have. Everybody in the universe knows classical gas.
Yeah, you know, it's done really well. And Christopher Parkening, who's a famous guitarist, said he's played all over the world, and he's never played anywhere that someone didn't ask him if he knew it. And he can play it, of course, but he doesn't play it in concert. It's not exactly his cup of tea.
Yeah.
But he admires the fact that classical gas made so many people interested in learning to play fingerstyle or classical guitar. And he said it's a wonderful contribution that you've made to music and that you've inspired people to pick up the guitar and learn to play not only it, but all the other tangential tunes associated with fingerstyle guitar. And alive and well.
It's alive and well. And we're going to talk about that time-wise when we get to it. I just wanted to let everybody know right away, this is the guy. Uh-huh. This is the classical gas guy. If they know nothing else, everybody on the planet has several copies of a version of classical gas in their head or on their record shelf.
Yeah, about 300 or so that I know of.
Let's talk about that. Let me read this first. Here,
okay.
Out of the volumes that you sent me, which I've poured over and read and listened, you have a bare bones and short bio that I think is not only typical of the accomplishments in a kind of a very humble approach, but it's also typical in what I hear in the music and also see in the writing and in the conversations we've had leading up to this. There's this underlying humor that is not always hit over the head humor, but there's a sly sort of a humor in many of the things that you do. And I'm going to read this little paragraph. You know what I'm talking about. This is your bare bones that you wrote. I'm going to read this because I think this says a lot about who Mason Williams is. This is entitled A Bare Bones Bio by Mason Williams. I've recorded and released 7 singles, 24 albums, and 2 EPs. I've written 250 songs, half of which are pretty good, one of which, Classical Gas, is apparently really good. I played at least 1,300 gigs in a lot of different places. I've written hundreds of poems, plus a bunch of other stuff, and created a whole bunch of art, too. Published 16 literary art books and 5 music books. Written 174 hours of broadcast television, and then parenthetically, and even more hours of unbroadcastable television. received 13 awards and 8 nominations. That's it for me. If you're interested in anything else, visit www.masonwilliams-online.com. Now, that's the shortest thumbnail possible to describe what you've accomplished, but that gives the listeners, in the very first bit of this interview, the breadth of what you've done. I mean, it goes back from the early folk days, which we want to start with, and your musical influences, and even current today, and all the stuff that you've done. You've transitioned through a period of music in America and the world through the 60s, and just done it with perfect aplomb, and still continued on, and still are very vital and very relevant to what you're doing. And I'm just having a blast listening, and I'm so glad to get to talk to you so you can explain, how did you do all this stuff?
Well, you know, you're the sum total of all of your artistic endeavors, and so I was fortunate to love music, and then I got involved in the writing of poetry and in writing songs, and then I got a chance to write comedy television for the Smothers Brothers and other people, Steve Martin and Saturday Night Live, all kinds of opportunities, and my art friends inspired me to sort of dabble in art, and all of this stuff eventually sort of crosses over into the different interests. So what you do in music starts to show up in your writing, and what you do in writing starts to show up in your art, and so it's all like cross-pollinization of all your interests.
Okay.
And you're the sum total of all of your endeavors eventually.
You're right. Okay, that's kind of the broad stroke out of the box. Let's go back to the musical influences that got you through all those little channels that you've run through. Let's talk about.
Let's see. Well, I grew up I was born in Abilene, Texas, and raised there, and I was living with my grandmother and my mother, and my dad was overseas in World War II, and so I was living with my grandmother and my mother and her sisters, and one of her younger sisters played music all day. She had a record player, and they were all 78 records back then, and she would play music all day, and I would sort of hang around her as much as possible and listening to all those songs that she played, and most of it was country, some pop, but it was, you know, gosh, the mainstream country artists of the time and in the 40s, and my first musical experience that I really remember was she left a record on her record player and went off to do something, and I had watched her turn it on. So I went over and I turned it on and I put the needle on the record, and I listened to it over and over and over, because it was an interesting experience and that's what she would do, is listen to the same thing she liked over and over. And here was the song that she left on the record player. Amor, amor, amor. These words so sweet that I repeat mean I adore you. Amor, amor, my love. Can you deny this heart that I have placed before you? So anyway, it was this real sort of...
A bonus. We had a live performance by Mason Williams on the Unreal Bluegrass Show. How was that?
So it was this crooner ballad. And
okay.
The odd thing was, as I listened to it, and I over and over, and at one point I kind of swooned or went into a trance over it, and I thought, boy, this music, even at 6 years old, man, this music is powerful stuff. So that was, and it's funny that you know, I guess because of that experience, I remember that song. And, oh, I was crazy about funny things, but it was all those the great country artists that she played all day long. And so, and that's your life, really, is you know, when you're very young, you're going to be listening to the music that the adults around you are listening to. And
you still do it well, Mason, by the way.
Oh yeah, I'm a pretty natural singer, and I think it's because I sang along with all those songs on the radio over the years, and it didn't matter, girl or boy, I tried to sing what it was. You were just interested in the melodies and the lyric, and so you just get caught up in this magical world of pop music and country music. And I was also the kid that sang the naughty songs at recess when I was in grade school. And, you know, I would sing something like this. Davy, Davy caught it, gave it to the whole frontier. And so,
wait a minute. In grade school you sang that?
Huh? Well, yeah, that was that was probably beginning of junior high school.
Oh, okay, okay.
And here's another one that I remember. Okay. There were a lot of them, but this one I remember. If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, don't you know you'll feel better if you cry? And my version was, when those gas pains start moving toward your heart, don't you know you'll feel better if you cry? So,
okay.
I didn't really realize it, but that was the beginning of art as well. Not only was it funny, but because art is where you imply something but don't quite say it or do it.
So that was
what was fun, was to, since I sang well and could imitate all of the pop singers, didn't matter who they were, a little hard to do Tennessee Ernie Ford with "You Load 16 Tons." I can do it now, but
when you're in the seventh grade, I don't think.
Eight to nine, 10 years old, you can't quite sing that low. And through high school, I sang along with the radio like most young people do, and they still do today, I'm sure. And they're singing along with their phones today, which is a little different.
That's strange, but yeah.
Same thing. And I had a singing group in high school called the Imperials, and one called the Nightlighters or something like that. It was three guys and a girl, and we sang, you know, "Memories Are Made of This," different songs like that, and a lot of the, in Oklahoma City where I grew up, we sang what they were called Race Records, and they were the black, "Work With Me Annie" and "Cherry Pie" and all those great songs.
And Mason, the year we're talking about here is what, just so we know the time frame?
I'm sorry?
The year, the time frame we're talking about when you're talking.
That would be 54, 55,
okay.
56.
Okay.
And so this group I had was in my last year of high school, which was 56. And, one thing I noticed was because I was thinking about classical gas as an instrumental hit, and back in those days, back in the 50s, there were a lot of instrumental hits. There was Nelson Riddle, Lisbon Antigua, and all kinds of hits. How about this one? Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom
White.
White, yeah. Sort of scoopy stuff.
Yeah, okay.
That was the number one hit
for a long time.
Somewhere back in there, 55 or 56. And, I looked at a chart from back then, and about 20% of the songs were instrumental, I don't think that's the case anymore. It's all songs these days. And I'm not too plugged into the hit parade. I don't know if there is a hit parade.
There's not. There isn't. I know what you're talking about, but there is not one.
And after I graduated from high school, I moved to L.A. and was living with my friend Ed Ruscha at a boarding house, and I was going to be an insurance actuary. interested in math, and had worked for an actuary in Oklahoma City, an after-school job, and so I thought I was going to do that. And a jazz pianist came to the boarding house and would play little concerts after dinner for everybody there, and he looked like he was having so much fun that I decided, well, maybe I should look into music. And so I decided that I would drop math and go into music, and enrolled in Oklahoma City University as a music major. And I didn't know anything about reading music. I didn't know how to read music. Didn't even know what a treble clef and a bass clef was. So I had to work a lot of after hours to figure out how to read music. And it was a late start, but I did have this ability to sort of imitate people and inquire if I couldn't read the tenor part or the baritone part or the bass part or whatever I was singing. I could listen to the guy next to me and just copy what he was doing. And so I was leaning on the music of others and doing it by ear for quite a bit. And you're going to be a music teacher.
Yeah, Mason, you clearly have a good ear for, and that pops up throughout the rest of what you've done and recorded and continue to do what you've done, I should say. You clearly have a good ear for music and sound and blending all those things together. But the world will now know that the entire universe of insurance actuaries was lost because of a jazz pianist who came to Oklahoma City. That one encounter.
Yeah, well, you know, I was going to take those actuary tests. Boy, they were tough. And the first one was vocabulary, and man, it was this list of words I'd never heard of. And so I started trying to learn three or four new words a day, and that was really important because one of the things I later found out was that you form your thoughts with words, so the better your vocabulary, the better your thoughts,
okay. Mm-hmm.
You might say, and the more precise your thought can be. And so that helps with songwriting and writing comedy and writing whatever. And so everything you get introduced to is going to spring you forward. That's the thing about college was, you know, I was telling a student not too long ago, I said, well, you don't have to know necessarily what you're going to end up being when you go to college, because the point of college is you find out what's out there. Maybe you don't know about a field that you're going to be ultimately interested in, but in college you're going to find out about it. So if you know what you're going to be, then college, you know, is you're learning about that interest, but it, you don't have to decide what you're going
until
after college.
No, and the shame of it is, and we're not going to cover all of education in this thing, but the shame of it is that college has become vocational school rather than an opportunity to just learn and listen and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Okay, so you were out of high school, you were going into college, and you were continuing on this music endeavor, and then I kind of cut you off because of the insurance accident.
Was going to be a music teacher. You know, that was what music school was about, is that they were grooming you to be, a music teacher in elementary schools or high schools or whatever. But I met this friend of mine who played guitar and was really immersed in folk music, and so I sort of branched off into folk music by virtue of this one individual who made it come alive. And I bought a guitar for $13 and began to learn to play, and he knew how to play well, so I was copying him just like I was copying the singers in the choir. So a lot of it is you imitating the people that you are around and admire. And in music school, you study harmony and counterpoint and compositional techniques and all these various things. And I was able to sort of apply interest in folk music and classical music that they were teaching you. Because when you basically go to, when you're studying music at the university, you're studying the Bach chorale that used to be, and you know it's broader than that now, but that was the basic music. His music was so well thought out and consistent in one sense that when you studied harmony, you were studying the music of Bach. And there's all kinds of different directions to go after that with jazz and whatnot. But so I was getting this cross-pollinization of folk music and classical music, and that kind of set the stage for classical gas.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
And because, you know, I put the kitchen sink that I'd learned in music school into classical gas. It has an intro. It develops a theme. It goes through the circle of fifths. It has a pedal point. It does. Anyway, I can analyze it, but
it kind of swells up to this big, you know, momentous moment, and then it resolves itself.
Is that you? That's the great advantage of mm-hmm. going to school to study music is that you learn all of these elements that you can bring into your songs or compositions. So I think that it was great to learn about all these things, even though I didn't end up being a teacher. And I don't consider myself really a guitarist that knows how to play the guitar well enough to be a teacher. I have some friends of mine that are, and their knowledge of how to improvise and do all these other things is beyond me, but I do the best I can.
So you, in addition to this, understanding the music and reading it for the first time and getting to learn the harmonies and all these different parts that you've talked about, in addition to all the things that you've learned about the music and the parts of the music, you studied voice. You have a very distinctive, strong, powerful voice. And we talked about this before we started the interview, that you have mm-hmm. this almost perfectly clear folk music that's almost... It almost has an operatic sound at certain points, and we talked about that a little bit before as to why your voice is so clear and why the words are so clear and why that where you got that from.
I didn't realize this at the time, but I think that I sang well naturally because I was singing along with the radio and all those different keys and styles and this and that, and so you develop a voice that is experienced and. If you want to sing well, sing a lot.
Yeah.
That's the key to it. Mm-hmm. And but I think that I was talking to my friend Ed Ruscha about this, and I said a lot of musicians have character personas when they sing. You know, their voices are like flavored water. They're like coffee, tea, lemonade, beer, you name it. And my voice, I strive to be like water. Plain old water, and I suppose this, emanates from my interest in classical guitar, because it tends to be sort of pure compositional info, not much in the way of stylistic playing, and also my river show music, which we'll get into later, mm-hmm. is mostly about rivers, which is mostly about water, and so in order to sing all these different types of songs and things, you're better off just taking a straight line through it rather than, I admire Leon Redbone and all these other people who have what you would call, you know, Dr. John. They have what I would call character voices, and they're fascinating. But my voice was always sort of determined by this broad range of interests and singing well. I remember Jimi Hendrix saying that you don't, something I read by him, he says he was talking to his father or mother, and he said, "You don't have to sing well anymore." And I thought, boy, that leaves me out.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the right before I called you, as I'm going back through things and making my notes, the last thing I had playing before we hooked up again right now was the Of Time and Rivers Flowing album, which is connected with that whole water. That was a total mm-hmm. fluke. I was looking through things. I wanted to get back out of the folk and bluegrass era that I'd been listening to. I'd listened to it before, but I wanted to get right back into that, and that's where you have this analogy to your vocal singing and things. I thought it was an interesting connection. Not planned, but it worked out well.
In order to sing all those different styles, you basically that was the thrill of that show, is that you got to sort of get involved in those musics. And one friend of mine said, you love to get into a song and kind of see what makes it tick. You know, how's it constructed? What is it all? You know, what's that melody structure? And what are those chord changes? And what are those phrases and all these various things? So I did get to explore all those styles. And God, it was everything you could imagine
it's
in
everything.
The River Show.
Yeah, well, and I want to talk about that in detail later because it's later recording. And we're going to come back to that, too. But you are right. You sent me a recording that I don't believe was released from 1961. Am I correct that this was not released?
That was a duo with a friend of mine named Mike Settle, mm-hmm. who was a very famous musician. He wrote But You Know I Love You and was in the first edition and with Kenny Rogers. And he had this beautiful, high tenor voice. So we were a pretty good duo because I could sing sort of in the baritone range and he was up there on top and he played guitar well and I played 5-string banjo and guitar and recorder. And we had a bass player who played with the symphonies. So once again, you were bringing a classical element into your arrangements and things like that. I was exploring playing sort of 3-finger style banjo, the Scruggs style, but also classical banjo. You might want to play 3 Jolly Rogues.
Well, yeah,
that was a classical style banjo, and so you were just open to all the different approaches you could take on these instruments you were playing.
Well, this 1961 recording that you sent me, we're going to cut to a couple cuts from it, and then I want to talk to you about which version of Shenandoah we kind of want to put as a book in. But in this in this recording, Bowling Green, you are actually doing some Scruggs to my ear on the second string. You're doing some hammer on. It's almost like a little bit of a Foggy Mountain Breakdown thing, and it's
Well, the thing that, you know, you were sort of borrowing from a lot of different styles. You were playing kind of a calypso style on the banjo, and you were playing 3-finger scrug style, and you were frailing. And then there were these classical banjo players around, and you were copying some of their things. So once again, you were... just being drawn from a great many sources and applying them to your interests as a player and also in arranging, you know. And I played recorder, too. I played flute. But you had to play all of the instruments when I was at Oklahoma City University. You had to play a string instrument, a brass instrument, a woodwind instrument, and a percussion instrument. And I picked the flute and kind of fell in love with it and branched out from the flute into the recorder. And there's a version of let's see, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, you can chop this out. Anyway, there's a recorder tune on there.
There is. Oh, absolutely there is. It might be the Ash Grove, maybe?
The Ash Grove, right.
See, I listen to this stuff. You thought you really listened.
I remember playing the Astro Club in L.A.
You sent me 40 CDs, Mason. I listened to all of them. I'm telling you, I did. It's been a dedication of mine the last couple of months. What I would like to do.
Well, fortunately, a lot of them only had one cut off.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for blowing my dedication on that one. You're right. Some of them did.
But in the River one, that was like 35.
Oh, yeah, it went on forever.
35
now.
Tunes.
Yeah. What I want to do now, because you're right on the cusp of that, my favorite term for it is the great folk scare of the 60s. You're right on the cusp of that musical moment, I think. And you're also blending, and I've had discussions with more from the New York crowd and the East Coast crowd about how folk music kind of mingled in with bluegrass, and then bluegrass came out of that scene and everything. And you're right on the cusp of that folk music thing, and then also with the banjo work you're doing, you're picking up some of those influences from bluegrass. So what I would like to do now at this point of the interview, I would like to I'm going to play for the audience Bowling Green, and because you mentioned 3 Jolly Rogues of Lynn, I'm going to throw that in because of the style of playing that you're doing. I was going to play the Ox Driver. I can play that later because I think the Ox Driver is such a great, rousing sort of, you know, folk, you know, inspiring tune. But I want to take the opportunity to play Bowling Green and Three Jolly Rogues of Lynn. And then we can hear that. And then what I'd like to do after that, when we come back, I want you to tell me which version of Shenandoah, which is a classical folk tune, and you've recorded many times. Tell me which one you want to play when we get back. We'll come back from this break, and then I will say that we're going
to... I'll talk to you about the fact that I still sing some of those folk songs.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Shenandoah is definitely one of them.
All right, let's take a break now. We're talking to Mason Williams on Unreal Bluegrass. I'm having so much fun. We're going to play for you from a 1961 recording from Mason and Mike Settle and Dave Phillips, Bowling Green, which will show a little bit of Mason's adventures with five-string banjo, which continues. I'm going to play, because you mentioned, Three Jolly Rogues of Lynn. And later on in the program, I'm going to play the Ox Driver, because to me, that's just full-bore folk, you know. That to me just drives the whole. But so this is right in 1961, right at the beginning of that really recordable folk music we get out of the field recordings and you guys are doing. It's a great album, by the way. So let's do that.
I never released it.
Oh, I know.
It's just a sort of an archival thing that I happened to dig up because Mike and I were in touch, and I said, "Hey, I've got a tape of us singing together, and I'll make a CD out of it." So that's where that came from.
Well, we need to get some light on it. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to play those tunes, and we'll come back in just a second. Thanks. Hold on, just one second.
Okay, no.
All right. There we go. That's part one of a conversation with the one and only Mason Williams. So nice of him to be available. We're broken this into parts. We will come back to the Shenandoah reference, and we will get to in the next section, which will be broadcast at a later date, we get to the Smothers Brothers, his time as the head comedy writer, hired as the head comedy writer for Roger Miller, and then the Smothers Brothers show after that. And he hired a young guy named Steve Martin to help him, also a banjo player. Isn't that odd? Hired a young man to help him write comedy. And then the world took off and continued, and Classical Gas went with it. What I'm going to play for you now is Bowling Green. This is from a folk album that was recorded in 1961 that Mason just did talk about. We're going to play Bowling Green. You'll hear his three-finger approach, which improved. And then you're going to hear Three Jolly Rogues of Lynn. Then just for fun, I just decided during that portion of the interview, I'm going to drop in a cut of a version that he did of Classical Gas. You all remember it, but, you know, gosh, you have to listen to him talk about it. Don't you have to hear it again? This is Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. Thanks so much for tuning in. Mason Williams, thanks, man. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the effort that you put into being on the program. We will continue this at another date. We have a lot more to do.